My name is Jeremy Darling, and for those of you that don't know me, I'm from Minneapolis. Up in Minneapolis, I go to a church called The Rock, which is your sister church. It's a church much like this one. We're up in South Minneapolis. A lot of young families at The Rock. I helped start that church in 1999, and a few months later, I was 17. I met a girl named Gretchen. She was a hot mess. Came to The Rock. Life had sort of collapsed in on her, and she got saved shortly after she came to The Rock. She found Jesus, and we very quickly became best friends, which for me was a brand new experience. Growing up, I never had a best friend. I barely had any friends actually as a child. And that fall of 1999, I took her for a walk, and I said, "Look, I don't want to do this with anybody else. And I'd like to marry you someday. And I wanted you to know that." And she did feel the same way about me. We got married in 2002, September 1st, 2002. We're heading into our 16th year of marriage now, and we got three little boys. Wyatt is 8. He's the consummate oldest child. He's very responsible. He loves to help. He always wants to help, which is huge when you have more than one child. And Wilder is 5. Wilder's a very special kid. He almost died during childbirth. It was very traumatic labor for my wife, and I won't get into that story because I don't really like talking about it anymore. But suffice to say, he survived, but his brain... During the childbirth, when a baby has a very traumatic birth, your brain kind of cocoons to protect itself from trauma. And so it took him a while to speak. He didn't really say much until he was about 3 years old. And even now, when you're with him, he's a little more like a three-year-old in his mindset and his personality. But he's coming along very quickly, and eventually I'm sure we won't even know anything was ever really different about him. He's extremely, extremely cuddly. He loves to jump off couches. He learned to talk really from Netflix. We found that the best way for him to speak, we had him in speech therapy, and he just hated it. He just hated it. So we put on things like Little Einstein and Just in Time, and he would just start quoting lines verbatim. And now he seems to know the appropriate places and social settings to deliver these little one-liners. So we're very excited to see him grow. Our youngest is baby Wren. We have a Wren as well. It's a boy Wren, and we're hoping maybe at some point, 18 years down the road, they might find each other. I don't know. Yes. We have a handshake agreement and a dowry set in place. Wren is a total maniac. He eats more. This is not an exaggeration. He eats more than both his brothers combined every day. He is eating me out of house and home. He's not this big old fat kid. I mean, he was as a baby, but he's sort of leaned out now, which is really sad. But he just eats an excessive amount of food. He's eaten dog food, deodorant. I caught him eating deodorant once or twice. Pencil erasers. We do watch him. It's just that he's everywhere. And he's a total blast, and we love him. So I got three boys with the only girlfriend I ever had, and we're having a really good time together in that home up in Prior Lake. We got 11 acres of land we just moved to. We're going to make a little hobby farm, and I've got a well and a water pump and a creek, and I'm going to get my boys outside. They're going to help me tend the land. So we're very excited. I'm up in Minneapolis. I'm a musician, a speaker, and an actor. That's primarily what I do for a living. I run a charity called The Salvage Project. I do concerts in prisons, shelters, halfway houses all over the country. I've toured about a third of the U.S. in the last 3 years or so, and I've got tours pretty much every month here through June. I only tour about 5 or 7 days a month at the most. I want to be home with my kids. I want to be a great husband and a great father. That's really my passion in life. So I try to be home as much as possible. When I'm not on the road, Part of the work that I do in the Twin Cities is a volunteer music therapist. So I'll go and I'll sing for people that are sick or dying, people that have Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. I do a lot of work with homeless and at-risk youth, running songwriting groups there, and for disabled veterans through the VA. It's my great privilege to be able to do those things. So that's kind of a nugget of my life. And one of my favorite things to talk about, maybe my favorite thing to talk about, is love. And when I go into these prisons and shelters and halfway houses, I learned very quickly, you can't just walk into a prison or a place where people have done bad things or where people are hurting, and you can't just walk in and say God loves you and expect that to change anything. Because intrinsically, when we're born, you know, it's interesting about babies. If you feed a baby and you change the baby's diaper, but you don't show it any affection or love, it will still die. I don't know if you knew that. It's called failure to thrive. Even as babies, we have this innate need to be loved. And then life and sin and Satan spend all their efforts trying to steal that from us as we grow up. You don't get to choose the family that you're born into. And your family, your upbringing, what was supposed to be sort of this central part of society, often is one of the greatest reasons we won't believe in a God or don't want to believe in a God, because of the things that happened to us as children. And we spend our life blaming God or wondering why he doesn't love me or what I did to deserve the things that happened to me. So I've learned I don't walk into those situations and open the night by saying, hey, God loves you, because they've heard that a lot and they don't really believe it anymore. And the reality is that word love has been hijacked. It's been hijacked primarily by Hollywood. It's been hijacked by pornography. And what we're getting is a very twisted, bent, dirty, broken, cut up, bloody excuse for what love is supposed to be. So before we can talk about love, I want to go back to the garden, back to the beginning. And I want you to understand something. You know, we at this church, we believe in one God. We believe in the Bible. We believe in Jesus Christ, and we believe in the creation version of events. Now, scholars and theologians and scientists, they can argue over the beginning, but the beginning really matters for the rest of our life, because how we were made really defines what we're going to believe about ourselves and why we're here. Because is not that the great question we all have, right? Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? So I want to take us back to creation. I believe many of us at this church, believe in the creation version of events, that a loving, benevolent God, an endless being of almighty power, decided that he wanted to give his love, the greatest force in the universe, because God is love, that he decided he wanted to give his love to a creation. So he made... It said God was hovering over the shapeless mass of the earth. He created this giant ball in the cosmos. And he began creating light and dark and day and night, sun and moon and stars. Then he put water onto the earth and all kinds of plants. Then he began creating creatures, animals, in the water, in the sky, and on the land. And then he created man. He said, I want to make man in my image. And from the dust, he rose a man, and he named him Adam. And he saw Adam was alone, so he began bringing all the animals to Adam so that he could name them and perhaps find a friend, someone to keep him company. But Adam didn't find a friend among the animals, and it seemed to almost surprise God. So he put Adam to sleep. He didn't need sleep at this time, but he put Adam to sleep. And he took a rib out of Adam's body, so Adam would always know something was taken from him to create a woman. And he woke Adam up, and there she was, a friend, a lover. And for a time in the garden, it was just the three of them, God and Adam and Eve. And I don't know how long this time was or at what point Satan and his minions rebelled in heaven and were cast down to earth. But one day, God was on a walk with Adam and Eve, and he took them to a tree. It says in the center of the garden, in the center of utopia, he took them to this tree. It was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he gave them one rule. You can have all of this. Okay, everything in this garden is yours. Just don't eat the fruit on that tree, or you'll die. As humans, we have a funny way when we read things, when we read through history, we have a funny way of just sort of reading it without questioning anything. Okay, this is a story. Maybe this was history, or we're in Sunday school as children learning about how something happened. But the why here is very important. Why would God create death? Why would God give them an instrument with which to destroy the world? I mean, if you're going to do that, if it were me, I would put it on the other side of the world, and I would explain that there's like a 20-year journey they could take if they built a boat, you know, and they could travel to this tree where they could eat fruit and die. Why would he do that? Why would he put that tree there? I'm going to come back to that. I want to read you a couple of quotes. As we need love. This is from Christopher Morley. I thought this was fascinating. If we all discovered that we had only 5 minutes left to say all that we wanted to say, every telephone would be occupied by people calling other people to stammer that we love them. Isn't that interesting? Babies die if they aren't loved. And if suddenly the world was going to end, a giant meteor was going to crash into Earth and kill us all, and we only had 5 minutes, we'd just be picking up phones or running to the people that we love. It is the most powerful, important force in all the universe. But now we hear this quote all the time, you know, love is all we need. Love will find us. Love will save us. Love will find a way. Hashtag love, not hate. But what does love really mean? Right? Because no one's ever really bothered defining it for you in anything but the vaguest possible terms. What does it actually mean? What does it look like? And I want to make an argument this morning that until we know the one that made love and why he made it, the author of love, the creator of love, you'll never really be able to experience love, to give it to someone else or receive it or even recognize it if it crosses you in the street. Because you don't know the one that made it, the creator. All we're getting are little whiffs, brief glimpses, a rush of emotion, something physical, a brief sexual relationship, and then it's gone. And we're back looking for love again. It's this cry within our heart that somebody would love me. You know, it's interesting, every civilization from the beginning of time, there's two common things, we talked about this last night, that bind us all together. Every civilization has worshipped some kind of God. There has never been an atheist civilization that simply sprung up. Now, communism tried to stamp out God under a boot and murder and mass starvation, but they still couldn't do it. Every civilization has needed to worship some kind of God, almost like it's written in our DNA, a desperate need to know there's a deity out there that cares about us. Why we were made. And the second thing that binds us is every civilization from the beginning of time has had marriage. There's never been a society that did not have some kind of marriage or matrimonial ceremony. Almost like it's written within our DNA, a desperate need for a lifetime companion. And does that not echo the garden? All the way back to the garden, God creates man. Man now has God. Man's still alone, so God creates woman. Now man has woman. Woman has man. And mankind now has God, and our needs are now met. But then the tree. What I want to do this morning is I want to give you a definition of love, as we see from the Bible, and then we're going to read in the Bible what love actually looks like when it's played out, so that we can all begin to recognize when we're here at church how we can love each other appropriately, and how we can learn to live a life of love. Oof. Write that number down. There you go, Jay. No sweat. So what is love? I wanna offer a definition, and you wouldn't know this because I didn't tell you this part at the beginning. But I go into schools a lot, and I get to talk about love and healthy relationships. They don't let me talk about God, which is just a nightmare for me to not be able to say his name. But I do the best I can. They may not let me talk about God, but they can let me talk about his ways. They just don't know it. And I offer this definition of love to these kids because they don't understand. Love is three things. The encumbrance of love is three things. Number one, love is forever. Real love is a lifetime commitment. I love my sons forever. I'm never going to give them up for adoption if they bug me too much or I have irreconcilable differences with my sons. Right? They're my boys. They'll always be my boys. I love my parents forever. Now, some people have terrible parents. I know that. I spend a lot of time trying to fix those kids. But I have great parents. I will never emancipate myself from my parents if we have irreconcilable differences. And I love Gretchen forever. Now, I know it sounds crazy, right? Because it's romantic love. Romantic love is different. Jeremy, you can't see the future. What if someday you meet someone you're more attracted to or have better chemistry with? You and your wife have irreconcilable differences. Blobbity, blobbity, blobbity. I don't have to play by those rules. Here's a few things I do happen to know about my future, even though I can't predict it. I will never rob a bank, no matter how broke I get. I can say that with certainty. I've been broke, by the way. I will never punch an old lady in the face, no matter how angry I get. And I've been angry. I mean, never at an old lady, but I've been angry. I know those things, and no one would question my sanity for staying out loud. Every bit as much as I know I'm never going to leave Gretchen because I love her, and love is forever. And by the way, I did promise at a wedding in front of witnesses by giving a sacred vow that I would never leave her in sickness and in health. And if my little boys can't even trust me to keep the promise I made to their mother, who I'm regularly sleeping with, how in the world do these boys trust me not to eventually fall out of love with them someday as well? They couldn't. You see, even a child knows when love ends, something's wrong. And this is why divorce is so painful for children, because it teaches us the first great lie about love, that is temporary and has conditions. It does not, and it is not. I recognize there are times in abusive relationships where divorce is the only option, and I've encouraged people to get out. Get out of an abusive relationship. Emotionally, physically abusive relationship. Get out. Most divorces don't end that way, though, right? Number two, love is selfless. I change my son's poopy diapers every day, not because I enjoy it or it benefits me in any way to do this. For those of you who've changed poopy diapers, you would know when the poop gets under your fingernails or on your hands because you're moving too fast or the baby wiggles around, you really begin to reconsider why you do that every day. But there I have been on my knees the last 8 years changing diapers for three different boys every day. They poop every day. I don't like how it smells. I don't like looking at it, right? But I do it because they need me to. They're just babies, and I'm their daddy, and they're my baby. So I put aside my preference for not seeing or smelling or looking at or touching poop, and I change their diapers, right? I try to put Gretchen's needs above my own. That doesn't mean she always gets what she wants, neither do I. That's not love. But at the end of the day, their lives now matter more than mine, right? Number three. Love is a choice. Believe it or not, Gretchen chose to be with this for the rest of her life. I did not blackmail her. I did not give her a love potion. She actually picked me, and I picked her. And in that choice, love can now blossom and grow. It cannot grow in a vacuum, meaning you must choose to love someone based on all available evidence. If there is force, pressure, deception, lies, coercion, violence in the relationship, there cannot be love because you must be free to choose. It's your right. It's the essence. It's the beginning of love, and that's why God showed them the tree. See, God did not want to create robots or pets with no free will, no conscience. It was their choice. Now, love could truly enter into the equation, into their relationship. He could give them an option. He could give them an out. What he was saying was, if you want to be with me, you can be with me. If you don't want to be with me, you can eat that fruit. And you can go your own way. The reality is, as much as we may not want to admit it, love cannot exist without pain. And we fool ourselves into thinking all these centuries that God is just up there distantly, ignoring our cries, maybe because we've done too many bad things. Maybe he can't hear us. And then we get more calloused over time and just begin to think he doesn't really care about me. Maybe there is no God. This is why the life of Jesus is so important. Why it's so important, because in Jesus we saw God coming down here living as us. And Jesus cried a lot. And you can be assured that God is not only collecting all of your tears in the bottle, but he is weeping himself every day as he's been forced, because of the deal he made with man to give them free will, he's been forced to watch every rape and murder and abuse that has ever happened. And he's up there weeping as he watches this precious creation he made and loved tear each other apart every day. In spite of all the evidence of the existence of God, of a man named Jesus that came here and died on the cross and changed the world forever, we still ignore him and we still blame him. Love cannot exist without pain. So love is forever, it's selfless, it's a choice. How can we know that? Well, if you believe in the Bible, that's the kind of love you see. The forever love of God haunting us through all of time, chasing us, pursuing us relentlessly through all of time. The selfless love of Jesus on the cross. Love will die for the ones that it loves. And Christ died for everybody. And the choice he gave us in the garden, to love him or to not love him. Love is forever. Love is selfless. Love is a choice. What does that look like in our real lives? Because until you know God, it's impossible to be able to give that kind of love or receive that kind of love to anybody else. The Bible gives us a great visual interpretation of what love looks like in our daily life. And it's in 1 Corinthians 13. Paul writes, "If I could speak all the languages of the earth and of the angels, but didn't love others, I would only be a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If I had the gift of prophecy, and if I understood all of God's secret plans and possessed all knowledge, and if I had such faith that I could move mountains, but didn't love others, I would be nothing. If I gave everything I have to the poor and even sacrificed my body to the flames, I could boast about it, but if I didn't love others, I would have gained nothing." And here it is in verse 4. Love is patient and kind. Well, it's very hard to be patient and kind. People aren't patient and kind back to us, isn't it? Love is not jealous or boastful or proud. Boy, are we living in an age filled with more jealousy and pride than at any other point in human history? I think we are. You turn on the TV, you open up your phone, You go for a drive, and all we can see are the things that we don't have, the things that we want. And so we try and convince ourselves that we're okay. And in social settings, we go about, we talk about ourselves, things that happen to us, hoping people feel sorry for us or are somehow impressed by the things that we've done. Wanting to be liked, so we talk about ourselves. Love is not rude. It does not demand its own way. For those of you in this room that are married, you understand how complicated that is, but how wonderful it feels when someone you love and someone who loves you does not demand their own way, right? It's not irritable, and it keeps no record of being wronged. That's what we do, though, right? We keep a running log in our mind of the relationships so that when someone says we've offended them, we can tell them all the things they've done that have offended us. Right? It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful and endures through every circumstance. And it sounds impossible, and it is impossible until we come to know Christ, until we let Christ in our life to revolutionize our life and our understanding of social mores, of what is and isn't good, and what love actually is. It is impossible. This is why I don't walk into prisons and shelters and immediately read this verse, because it sounds so difficult. First, we need Jesus. Prophecy, verse 8, prophecy and speaking in unknown languages and special knowledge will become useless, but love will last forever. Now our knowledge is partial and incomplete, and even the gift of prophecy reveals only part of the whole picture. When the time of perfection comes, these partial things will become useless. When I was a child, I spoke and thought and reasoned as a child. But when I grew up, I put away childish things. Now we see things imperfectly, like puzzling reflections in a mirror. But then we will see everything with perfect clarity. All that I know now is partial and incomplete. But then I will know everything completely, just as God knows me completely. These things, three things, will last forever: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. It sounds impossible to love somebody that way, but isn't that how you want to be loved? Don't you want somebody to be patient and kind to you, even when it's hard? Don't you want someone that you love to not hold against you all the things that you've done? There lies the definition of what our heart craves, a perfect love. And we find that perfect love first in God, and then we find it in the church, in his imperfect but holy and pure reflections. As people, we don't always get it right. We don't always get it right, but we're sure trying. We're sure trying. I want to read another couple of verses. Before I do that, I want to help us understand one of the keys to love is gratitude. This is from a wonderful man named Ravi Zacharias. Gratitude is indispensable to the highest form of love, and I believe it's the cornerstone of the answer for loneliness. Gratitude is the cornerstone of the answer for loneliness. See, appreciative love, gratitude, springs forth out of a gratitude to God for the very cause of my being. I don't deserve to be here. I don't deserve God to love me. I don't deserve any of the good things that happened. I was simply born. It's a love that bends the heart and the will in worship, and it fills the loneliness or the beyond in our lives. I've often wondered if that's why atheism is so barren. It has nobody to thank. A thankless life loses gratitude and wonder. Love is eager to show gratitude. When we really begin to understand the love of God, it makes us very thankful people. Meaning, it isn't needy. Do we have needs? Of course we have needs. God's great desire is to satisfy all of our needs. When we come to church, we often come trying to take what we need from other people. That's not what church is for. At church, we come together to love each other and fellowship and to learn about God and how he would want us to live. And when we come to church, it's our job not to sit and learn and eat, but to show gratitude to the people here that loved you, that have loved you when you've been very hard to love, that have loved you even when they didn't feel like loving you, right? that gratitude and that understanding of gratitude helps us come and interact with people in such a new and unique way. We're not looking for what we can take from them or for what they can provide for us or for what void they can fill, because people can't do that. Only God can do that. When we really understand that God came down to earth and gave up his rights as God and lived just like we did, was a baby born from a woman's body just like we were, nursed from a woman's body just like we did, got sick, got tired, got injured, had a job, a hard job, just like we did. Knowing his entire life, even as a small child, exactly how he was going to die. I often wonder if he dreamed about it at night when he slept. That day that would come when he was 33 and they would tie him to a post and tear the flesh off his body and put his robe back on him. You know why they did that, right? Well, two reasons. They didn't want him to bleed out. So they covered his whole body in a robe. And then that robe, that wool cloth, seeped back and dried into all the wounds and closed them temporarily. And when they got to the hill where they would crucify him, they tore it off his body and they reopened up all the wounds. And then they laid him down on a cross. And they used 9-inch nails to nail his hands and his feet. They didn't often use nails. I don't know if you knew that. Sometimes they just tie you. I don't know if you understand crucifixion. I won't get into the gory details. It's not the bleeding that kills you. It's a slow suffocation. That's why they would put your feet on blocks or nail them in so that you would use your feet to lift your body back up and take a breath as the weight of your body and your muscles failing would crush your lungs. And it took hours to die. And then he took every bad thing you've ever done, every bad thing you've ever done, every bad thing you've ever, you're ever going to do, and he buried them. And when we understand that kind of love, that kind of mercy, that undeserved favor, it should fill us with gratitude. I did not deserve him to do that for me. See, that moment changed all of human history, didn't it? Christmas, Easter, to this day, thousands of years later, are still celebrated around the world, no matter how hard we try to make Christmas about gifts and Santa Claus and Christmas carols, no matter how hard we try to make Easter about a bunny and pastel eggs and chocolates. You cannot take Jesus Christ out of history. Make no mistake, they're trying to do that, and many people trying to do that. There's something so profound about this man's life, his birth, and his death, and then his resurrection, because it's not the death that saved us. It was his resurrection, proving, in fact, he was God. Something so profound about these two moments in history that all the world would never be the same. We can know he came. We can know he died. We can know he rose again, and that fills us. It needs to fill us with a gratitude that God loves me no matter how bad I am, and we can prove it. What was the last thing Jesus did before he died? Do you remember? He was hung in between two thieves, two other criminals. Yeah. Yeah. He made sure his mother was taken care of. But there were these two criminals on either side, and they were making fun of him. And then one looked over and realized what he was doing. He said, you know, he doesn't deserve to be here, but we do. And then he looked at Jesus, this criminal, and he said, would you remember me? Would you remember me when you get to paradise? This man had done nothing to fix, to right his wrongs. He had done no good deeds that would supposedly deserve him a right and a place in heaven. And Jesus looked over him, and he did the very thing he said he'd come to do. He absolved the man of his sins right there. And he said, today you'll be with me. As apparently, even a criminal, in his last breath, can receive salvation, having done nothing to earn it, having only asked for it. Most of us in here, we got life left to live. We know Jesus. We need to live that life with gratitude. And that's what's going to make you confident in who you are in these social settings. You're not coming to church looking for people to let you down. Imperfect people, by the way, imperfect people will let you down. Just like imperfect cars will let you down. Imperfect phones will let you down. Imperfect people will let you down, even those at church. What we need is from God. And our gratitude, that joy, it radiates. You've all met someone like that. They're so happy. They're so nice. They're always asking about other people. It's because they understand. They understand. I don't deserve what I have. I don't deserve my wife. I don't deserve my kids. I spend every day of my life proving to God his death was not wasted on my life. And I'm thankful for what he did. I want to read another verse. Mark 12. Jesus is talking to Peter shortly before he died. And he asked Peter a very strange question. He said, Peter, do you love me? He said, of course I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. Okay. Then Jesus asked him again, Peter, do you love me? Peter said, I just said, yeah, I love you. I take care of my sheep. And then a third time, Jesus said, Peter, do you love me? Lord, yes. Now he's offended. I love you. Of course I love you. I take care of my sheep. It's ironic. Shortly after Jesus was arrested, they took him into this courtyard, and Peter snuck in through the gates and hid in the back. And someone recognized Peter, a young girl, and said, hey, don't you know Jesus? He said, nope. Then someone else looked at him and said, no, I think I've seen you with Jesus. Peter said, nope, it's not me. You got the wrong guy. And then a third time, someone said, No, I know. You're one of his disciples. He said, damn it, I don't know the man. He was scared. I think that story is interesting because Jesus knew, asking Peter those questions three times, knowing what would come. Peter, of course, the early church was built on the back of Peter and his great works when Jesus left the earth. But I find that one of the most beautiful, poetic, and ironic stories in the Bible. One, because of what Jesus is implying. If you love me, and it's not just, he's not just talking to Peter now, he's talking to us. And take care of my sheep. Take care of each other. I can't tell you how many times the church has come through for me. In fact, this church, these people, you guys are taking care of me. Every time I come here, I need to stay in someone's house and eat their food, be comforted and encouraged by them. And almost 2 years ago, I was down here lamenting a great trial in my life. My third baby was due, and I just lost the money that I had been saving to pay for that little baby for my deductible. And this church said, well, we can help. And you guys raised a bunch of money, and you just gave it to me. So he's kind of your kid. I mean, I'm not going to, like, bring him down here and give him to you. I really like him. But he's kind of your kid. And right there in that moment, these people that I don't get to see very much show me that they love me, that I matter to them. And most in here have stories just like that, too. They bought you food when you needed it, paid your bills when you needed it, let you live in their house when you needed it, and were kind to you even when you were a blubbering, ugly mess, right? That's love. And we see that in the Bible, and we can only give that love when we've received it ourselves. One more verse, and then I want to close with a thought and a song. This is Romans 12:9. Love in action. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love, honoring one another above yourselves. There's that selfless love. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Don't take revenge. Leave room for God's wrath. For it's written, it's mine to avenge. I will repay. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That's real love. That's real love in action. It's the real love that our heart craves. And the kind of love, the only kind of love that we can know when we know Jesus Christ. And we've embraced him as our Savior. I want to close with a song, and then we'll pray, yeah? When I go to these prisons and shelters and halfway houses,